Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. We are coming to the end of April with summer just around the corner. Equity markets have already begun heating up this spring, and Q1 earnings season reaches a peak this week with about 40% of the S&P 500 reporting. The Federal Reserve's FOMC meeting is also on Wednesday, which is likely to be Jay Powell's last as Fed chairman. So joining us to discuss this all on this Monday morning, glad to once again welcome back Jason Trejo, the head of asset allocation for the Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office. Jason, great to be back at the table with you on this Monday morning. Thank you for dropping by.
Good morning, Dan. Good to be here. Happy Monday.
So, Jason, for the first time in 2 months, I did not mention the U.S.-Iran war as part of the lead-in. Despite that, of course, does remain a factor which merits monitoring. What is the latest CIO view on the conflict, and what does it mean for the markets at this point?
It is sort of noteworthy. We're I think, almost exactly at the two-month kind of anniversary when this began. I don't want to make light of the situation. It's still obviously ongoing. But I think from a markets perspective, we've kind of reached a point where kind of have the ceasefire that's sort of holding, but not a clear ceasefire. Also, just thinking about last week, the off-again negotiations, like reports that, for example, J.D. Vance is on a plane to, Islamabad, and it turns out he's not on a plane, back and forth. So I think the markets are, kind of a little bit exasperated by it, but also, we just don't know. What we seem to have is a bit of a stalemate, seem to be past the peak uncertainty. Now the real question is, when does the Strait kind of open up sufficiently that oil can start flowing through, because that's not been the case thus far. So if you think about the market performance, given that we're just not getting new information from from the Middle East, investors have kind of moved beyond the war, and kind of ceasefire discussions as the primary market driver. And then you can see market pricing is somewhat desensitized, to what it was, to the price of oil. And you could just see how much as price of oil goes higher, how much you've seen bond markets, equity markets respond. Still negative, but rate of change has become much smaller. What we have is the markets are much more focused on kind of the AI narrative once again, kind of going back to where we were, 2 months ago in February. Reports of CapEx spending, and last week, with one company, Intel, reported very good numbers, mm-hmm. caused their stock price to go up 20%+. And so that's kind of where what's the key things is earnings. We'll get into the macroeconomic data from the conflict itself. The way the market's ultimately kind of basis on is when will we get at least an opening of the strait, and whether there's ceasefire or not ceasefire, mm-hmm. How long that plays out, that's almost, again, from the market's perspective, sort of secondary. Can there be something that would open up the strait that will allow oil and other goods to ship through? The latest reports overnight is perhaps the Iranians were floating an idea that we can do something on the strait, even if we don't necessarily negotiate clear deals on, mm-hmm. Nuclear disarmament. So for us, what we are assuming then is the strait will kind of gradually open up enough such that ultimately, what is the price of oil going forward? Again, 2 months ago, the futures market was pricing, Brent crude to be, less than $70 a barrel throughout 2026. Now, in our base case, is that we're going to assume that oil is going to be $100 a barrel in June, and we're a little bit over that now. Mm-hmm. But then 95 by September, 90 by December. So kind of kind of peaked out around now, but a pretty gradual descent for the rest of the mm-hmm. year. And that's going to be a bit of a drag on growth. We could be wrong about that. Things could escalate. This could take much, much longer for the strait to open up, or at least supplies to move forward enough that prices can go lower. That is the risk. But right now the markets are assuming something along those lines, and that this won't further escalate, and therefore we go back to more of the economic and AI fundamentals driving the markets.
Moving along, I did mention that the FOMC is meeting this week. We will receive the outcome on Wednesday. In addition to that, it does appear at this point that Kevin Warsh will get confirmed by the U.S. Senate over the next few weeks. What is your expectation for the Fed this week and under Kevin Warsh?
Well, just for this week, don't expect very much. They're not going to hike or cut. I think that's almost, carved in stone. The communication changes are somewhat limited because they will update their statement, but there's no change in economic projections. There's no change in the dot plot. So it's likely the message this time, end of April, will be similar to what it was in mid-March, that they're going to very much in sort of a wait-and-see mode. They would feel policy as sort of in a decent place right now because the risks are somewhat two-sided. Inflation could stay elevated, go even higher if this conflict persists. At the same time, if it does persist and oil prices go higher, that will be a negative for the economy. The risk is then the downside to growth in the labor market. So they kind of have to balance it out for the time being, kind of comfortable, you know, sitting where they are. So a lot of the focus then will be, you know, where do we go from here? On Kevin Warsh, couple key things. One is that the Department of Justice sort of dropped its investigation into Fedchair J. Power Guarding, sort of the renovations and construction of the Fed, you know, building in D.C., pertaining to testimony before Congress. Like that's what the legal mm-hmm. situation is. That case has been dropped. That was a sticking point for Senator Tom Tillis from North Carolina, who sits on the Senate Banking Committee, who said, I will not, you know, vote to approve anyone for the Fed chair as long as this investigation is out there. Without his vote, there wouldn't be enough votes for anyone to kind of pass through the Senate Banking Committee, mm-hmm. which is a necessary prerequisite to go to the Senate floor to approve someone. Given the DOJ dropped its investigation on Friday, on Sunday morning, I think on one of the talk shows, Tillis said now he was willing to vote for mm-hmm. Warsh. So assuming the committee will vote the next week or two, goes to the Senate floor, it's likely they'll vote, you know, by May 15th. That's when Powell's run as chair would expire. Some of the mechanics of a voting, you know, senators in office or not, like that could, you know, disrupt a little bit. But very, very likely, if not by, mm-hmm. you know, May 15th, by the end of May, enough so that Warsh is in the role by the mid-June when the next OFOMC meeting takes place. So then the real question becomes, like, what does a Fed chair under Warsh look like? How does monetary policy change, if at all? You know, we are in an environment where inflation is elevated. It could go even higher, at least in the near term, before going lower. It would be hard to get your first meeting, a committee mm-hmm. kind of wrapped around the idea of actually cutting rates. And it is a committee. It isn't the chair has unilateral decision, can use moral suasion and arguments to try and sway the committee members. But if enough people are apprehensive, it'd be difficult to Warsh to get enough votes. And it'd be looked bad in your first meeting to try and push forward and vote for a cut. And the rest of the committee right. majority, you know, doesn't vote for it. What we can look at is, you know, kind of views of Warsh based on his testimony last week.
Right.
Similar to what he said before, you know, focus a lot on the balance sheet, wants to shrink the balance sheet. That is nothing new. Use more interest rates policy to kind of set Fed policy. You talked about the communication and sort of the idea that Fed perhaps over-communicates. And as a result, you know, the message and the guidance from the Fed is, you know, is not too clear. So there could be some change in Fed communication going forward, although it's part of its every 5 years the Fed does a review of its policy. One of them was their communication strategy. And what Powell had said at a press conference when asked about this earlier in the year was they could not agree on like how to change the mm-hmm. communication. So the idea that there'll be a massive change, I think that's kind of unlikely. I think the one notable thing that Warsh had mentioned during his testimony was the inflation metrics they think they should focus on, looking at trimmed mean inflation measures or median. So trim mean, the idea is that you take off like the most extreme, you know, say 10% of the top or the bottom. That could be, you know, kind of skewing things hard just because right. they're so elevated. Same thing with the median. Kind of the idea is that you kind of get rid of the extreme outliers that mm-hmm. can distort the overall average, which you could, you know, that's a data point one can look at. You know, if you look at it right now, I think the Dallas Fed, the Cleveland Fed have their own measures of sort of trimmed mean inflation. It is running like at 2.5%, 2.3% versus core PCE, which is what the mm-hmm. Fed relies on. That's like 2.9. So one can look at that and say, well, if you want to make an argument that you should be cutting rates, you can point to the inflation data that is on the low end of the spectrum. Independent whether it gets actually better to look at that. And you can have an intellectual argument. Mm-hmm. It just it's such that right now it actually favors cuts. So that could be an indication that Warsh is going to try and emphasize inflation is not so bad, that we should be moving towards cuts. Mm-hmm. Now, ultimately, our base case, you know, for a couple of months, and we knew Warsh was the nominee, was that the Fed would cut in September and December 25 basis points each, 50 total this year. Now, whether that ultimately gets pushed back a little bit, I think that's possible. But from the overall market perspective, that doesn't really make much difference. The point is that you have a Fed that is biased still towards easing, not hiking rates. That's very unlikely. And you have a Fed chair that seems to be more on the dovish end of the spectrum. How much it could also further change will be depend on whether Jay Powell decides to resign from the Board of Governors, and which would give President Trump a chance to appoint someone else, presumably someone who's on the more dovish end of the spectrum. There's still an outstanding case on Lisa Cook, whether she could stay on the board or not. If she's removed, again, you could have a more mm-hmm. clear shift towards, you know, dovish committee members. All of which, aside from the macro conditions, you know, the composition of the Fed would suggest that cuts are much, much more likely than hikes at this point in time.
Let's move along to the Q1 reporting season. As mentioned, a busy week ahead of us with 40% or so of the S&P 500 reporting. Jason, curious to hear about your reflections on the results we've seen thus far.
We've had about 25% of the S&P 500 market cap report. We look at both how much companies are beating their sales or revenue, but also how much they are beating their EPS estimates. And it's just shy of 80 companies are beating, sales and EPS. So good sort of results above historical averages in terms of beating earnings, which tends to be around 70%, and beating, you know, sales, which could be around like 60%. So good in that regard. It's also the magnitude of earnings beats is also ticked up, with the meeting company now beating by about 5%. So a healthy beat there. So the overall story, the data we have thus far, very much consistent with our CIO's expectation of 17% earnings growth in Q1. If anything, that's likely to be understated. We do get 40% of the S&P 500 market cap reporting this week, including five of the hyperscalers, which includes and hyperscalers. These are the companies investing enormous amounts of money on new data center buildouts. This includes Alphabet, Google, Facebook/Meta. Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon. They've continually sort of ramped up how much money they're spending on CapEx. If they kind of, again, sort of ramp up those numbers, you know, in the context of Q1, I think Facebook basically doubled their amount of investment for this year. So if we see that, that could, you know, again, sort of be a boost, for overall expectations in the market. Those companies may or may not be as rewarding, because what we've seen for the past few months and past few quarters is that the market isn't necessarily rewarding the CapEx spend of the hyperscalers, but it clearly has knock-on benefits for the whole kind of AI sort of, value chain. And we've seen that with other semiconductor companies, companies that are involved in building out the data centers, providing energy. So it's kind of a whole ecosystem. And so if those companies continue to spend, there's going to be beneficiaries elsewhere that would show up in earnings of other companies down the line. So I think it'll be, if they don't sort of beat and raise to some extent, right. The market could be a little bit disappointed if they do, and they kind of do what they've done in the past, where the numbers go up higher. That would be a further catalyst for the overall earnings outlook. So bottom line, we're a quarter of the way through. Our expectations are, at or likely to be better than what we've been assuming for earnings this year. But this week with 40% and those hyperscalers reporting, that will kind of either affirm that or suggest we were a little off base. Assuming it is affirmed, then again, it's sort of a constructive view for equities, U.S. equities in particular.
So with that, Jason, let's end today, as we always do, with asset allocation. Good timing, because I know the Chief Investment Office late last week released the latest House View update. What were some of the key messages within?
Well, we titled the main letter, Investing in a Fast-Changing World. I think it's that, and it goes without saying that these nearly four months into the year, like how much things evolve and continue to evolve on a very kind of rapid time horizon. Overall, it's still a constructive message that we think about the macro conditions, ultimately sort of positive on, U.S. economic growth, on inflation. I've kind of alluded to that in some of the prior answers, that still expect growth, at least in the U.S., around 2% trend. Inflation looks like it's going to peak in the next couple of months. Certainly tariff-related inflation, will go lower. You have a central bank, the Fed in particular, that's looking to cut rates, and other central banks that 6 weeks ago might have been thought by the markets to be hiking rates this year, and I'm referring specifically to the ECB or the Bank of England. Perhaps now what they do is, they don't do anything at all. So that is kind of getting us, kind of a supportive, tailwind overall for risk assets. Earnings story is just kind of, positive. So this leads us to kind of the overall equity messaging and kind of messages in general for, across different asset classes. I'll start with equities. The key message there is to kind of diversify across equities. We've had a very strong kind of bounce back. We've seen even in the past week or a couple of weeks, very strong bounce back in parts of tech and semiconductors in particular. This is all sort of justified by kind of the macro fundamentals, we think, the earnings stories overall. And so sort of remain constructive, but be cautious on terms of not having over-concentration to those handful of companies or sectors that have done very well. And as a result, thinking about diversifying within the U.S., diversifying within kind of the AI exposure, diversifying kind of globally. And so you think about you know, a core allocation. Well, one way to diversify is looking at more an equal weight allocation, you know, which kind of moves you down the kind of the market cap size. You can also look at other markets. You know, Japan, emerging markets, especially Asia, have done very, very well. And like they are key beneficiaries, you know, Korea, Taiwan, to the AI theme. Within sort of mega cap names and sort of the AI value chain, you can again sort of diversify into other areas, whether it's industrials, automation, robotics, things like that. So it's not just a kind of, you know, call specifically on you know, hyperscalers. And then on that last point, when we get these kind of rallies, and again, we might see the price action this week, you know, right, you know, post-earnings, how they play out. But given you, when you have these sort of rallies and bounce backs, you know, you can use them as opportunities to sort of rebalance into, you know, other strategies, other investments, you know, including even sort of structured, you know, kind of being, solutions, all of it just to sort of diversify the portfolio, but also kind of protect some of the downside, given how fast things have come back. So constructive view on equities, but sort of, you know, diversify. Don't you know, be beholden to, you know, the AI theme. On fixed income, you know, we've had a message for all kind of, you know, stay up in quality. Spreads have kind of come back quite a bit. So the kind of risk reward for a lot of, you know, this corporate fixed income doesn't look particularly compelling. Mm-hmm. Rather take the equity exposure of corporate America than the credit exposure. On kind of the rates front, you know, the market was, again, about a month ago, pricing in some chance of a Fed hike this year. We think they're going to cut. We've said that all along. The market's at least gone back to pricing in a 50% chance of a cut this year. We think the market will move more in that direction. So, you know, a message we have is lock in yields with the idea that, you know, where cash rates are now, they're probably going to go lower, they're not going to go higher, and the market still isn't sort of fully kind of pricing for that. So within fixed income, kind of favoring the front of the curve where we, you know, have more conviction the rates will go lower. Near term, the 10-year traded in between 4, 4.5, kind of in the middle of the range, likely to stay there. So not looking to make kind of big, you know, calls there. As part of the overall sort of fixed income landscape, I want to note that we also upgraded munis to attractive last week. They'd underperformed, you know, a little bit earlier in the year, but we think they're now poised to deliver much stronger performance going into the summer. They have a tax equivalent yield once you adjust for the tax differences versus, say, you know, treasuries or corporate bonds of over 6%. That's pretty attractive. The technicals sometimes are kind of weak, you know, especially around tax season. People have to pay the taxes. They kind of hold off. Now that's done. They have capital to deploy. So as we move into the summer, I think that's kind of a better, you know, kind of, you know, season for kind of the technical story for munis. So ultimately, we think they, you know, you have a chance to sort of outperform, certainly on a tax equivalent basis, you know, your treasuries and investment-grade corporate bonds going forward. And finally, just favorite commodities. Mm-hmm. You know, we've liked, you know, a variety of different commodities. We liked gold. We continue to like gold, and we think it will be kind of tailwind as interest rates go lower, especially the front of the curve, but other, you know, central banks and sovereign wealth funds continue to add exposure. Industrial metals will offer exposure to things like, you know, electrification and even sort of the build out of data centers. So it is, you're not just a gold call, it's sort of this kind of broader exposure in an environment where people are looking for diversification portfolios, you know, because inflation has remained elevated. There's inflation shocks. Commodities can help diversify portfolios.
Jason, thank you for dropping by on this Monday morning. A busy week ahead. You think about all of the earnings results, the FOMC meeting, and, of course, keeping our eyes open for any further developments as it pertains to the U.S.-Iran war. So a lot to monitor. Helpful guidance, reviewing the allocation recommendations per the latest CIO House view. So thank you again, Jason, for dropping by.
You're welcome. Have a good week.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, securities and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.